Ramon Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. May Martinez. Lunch at your desk and one ball per kid to play with alone. What the new norm could look like for LA school kids. Plus, a new documentary tells a story of a woman who kept quiet about sexual assault because she did not want to let a culture down.
Film really is meant to lift up Black women who love Black men, not to tear anyone down.
It's ahead on Take Two. From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take Two. I'm A. Martinez. It's Wednesday. Thanks a lot for being with us today. LA Mayor Eric Garcetti will join us later in the show, and he's going to talk about why the city is starting to open up right now, even though the cases of COVID-19 continue to climb.
We don't want to strangle this economy to the point where Los Angeles never comes back or it takes a decade to come back. That would be devastating. At the same time, it's not a time to just go have fun.
Plus, we're going to get some guidance on when Hollywood will get the green light to again roll film. But we start today with Los Angeles County Schools. There's new guidance today on how the county's 80 districts might resume teaching in the fall. Now, the 43-page report includes considerations for schools, including face-to-face learning, distance learning, or maybe a mix of both. The guidelines come by way of an LA County Office of Education task force, which was assembled to develop a plan for schools during the current pandemic. And for more on these guidelines, let's talk to KPCC reporter Carla Javier. Carla, welcome back.
Thanks, A.
All right. First off, why is this document even needed?
Well, remember back in March when schools started to announce that they were closing to slow the spread of coronavirus? There wasn't this like one decree. It was a decision ultimately made by individual districts and charter schools themselves. So in the same way, if and when school campuses reopen, that decision will also be made by local education agencies individually. So this task force was formed to give some suggestions, guidelines, things to consider as school leaders figure out what they will do for the 2020-2021 school year. Here's how LA County Superintendent of Schools Deborah Duardo put it when introducing this framework to reporters this morning.
They want to make sure that they have the resources, the PPE that they need to do it safely. The majority of them that I've spoken to are really looking to have some type of program where students are physically back at school in the fall.
So you can think of this framework as a list of things to consider to figure out if that will even be possible, and if so, how to do it safely.
And one of the things, Carla, that jumps out right away is that it by no means is a one-size-fits-all approach.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. This document is not a list of orders or directives that districts and charters have to adopt. Instead, it's more than 40 pages of suggestions or things to consider. And ultimately, administrators will get to decide for themselves what they'll do for their own schools based on the needs of their students and staff and school community, assuming that whatever they choose follows public health orders, of course. And on that point, State Superintendent Tony Thurmond also said today that the state will be releasing its own guidelines on school reopenings. And county officials said during the briefing today that they would recommend whichever guidelines are more strict. Well, for right now, anyway, the county's recommendation includes things like how classes will be held, if they'll be in person or continue through distance learning or some combination of the two. Also, how long people will be on campus and how physical spaces can be set up or altered to do that safely. These are all things that school leaders will get to consider and decide based on what works best for their schools.
And because we're in a pandemic, there's a major focus on health and safety. So what kind of steps is the task force suggesting there?
Yeah, a lot of the suggestions centered around how to keep everyone like physically distanced. So things like staggering schedules, so not everyone has to be in the lunchroom or on the playground at the same time, or maybe reducing class sizes so students have more space in between them and other students or them and their teachers. There was also a lot of emphasis in the recommendations on cleaning too, whether it's surfaces that are touched frequently like door handles and bus seats, a lot of talk of hand washing, maybe even installing more hand washing stations. They're encouraging less sharing of school supplies. And when it comes to face coverings, their suggestion is that everyone wears one.
And Carla, as a sports guy myself, to have one ball per kid playing alone, I mean, what are they going to do? These kids like to play with each other. I'm so sad.
Yeah, it's a real challenge.
Yeah, now, basketball, I guess they can shoot. They're going to be Steph Curry's all over L.A. Now, what I'm hearing is that, okay, so a basic school day is probably going to look different for kids in different parts of L.A. So based on the guidelines, how might a basic day look like?
Yeah, quite different than before. I'm still picturing that kid playing basketball on their own. I mean, that's one way it can look. It really just depends on what every district decides is best for them. Maybe a district will decide not everyone has to be on campus every day, or they might not have to be there for a full day. Maybe people will come on campus in shifts. School leaders might say make those recommendations when it comes to masks or face coverings, or they could limit entrances to just one to the school in case they want to screen people before they come on campus. Classrooms themselves will also likely look different. They'll probably look less crowded. For a traditional classroom, the recommendation is to keep it under 16 people. Students could be also placed in what the task force called stable groups. So they're with the same group of people everywhere they go. And maybe some classes would even move outside to help everyone just spread out a little bit more. There's also this recommendation to make hallways and stairways one way, so to change the way traffic like moves around the school. Or maybe students will stay in the same classroom and it'll just be the teachers rotating around and coming to them. And the day will likely have way, way, way more breaks for hand washing. Of course, those are just some of the many options that the task force provided in this framework.
Sure. And obviously, there are a lot of considerations for schools looking to reopen their doors. Many students depend on school lunches. Districts have to work with students with special needs. PPE will be needed. Social distancing, probably very difficult. Mm-hmm. Now, because these are just guidelines, Carla, what kind of decisions do schools and districts have to make now?
Well, I guess the first thing really is which ones, which guidelines they can and will adopt. We got a copy of a letter today addressed to the governor, to the county public health director, and to the county superintendent. It was signed by 10 local district superintendents. And these school leaders list really big concerns about what was laid out in this framework. They say that some of it just isn't practical, and they ask for flexibility on things like the distancing and the face coverings I was talking about. They're saying it might just be too expensive to execute those suggestions, or maybe too difficult to get kids to comply with them. And then, of course, there's the issue of paying for all of this between the face coverings for students and staff, renting maybe extra structures for classes, way more disinfectant, way less sharing. It's bound to be expensive. And that's all coming in a year of projected cuts to school budgets.
Really quick, Carla, any word from LAUSD about this?
Yeah, we reached out. They declined to comment today, but they said to look out for updates soon.
All right, that's KPCC reporter Carla Javier. Carla, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Wei.
All right, as mentioned, today's framework came to us from the LA County Office of Education Task Force. It's made up around 24 superintendents and leaders from districts around the county. One of them is Melissa Moore, superintendent of the El Segundo Unified School District. Melissa, welcome to Take Two.
Good afternoon.
Now, out of the box, Melissa, some of these new guidelines seem like they're going to be very difficult for many schools to implement. It might even be cost prohibitive. So based on the guidelines here, can you say right now if it's likely that students in your district will return to real life classrooms in the fall?
That's a great question. Obviously, the situation with COVID-19 continues to be ever evolving, and so the district is ready to have and respond to any option moving forward. It is our intent to open school on April 26th, and it is likely that that would be using a hybrid model that is outlined in the framework as one of the options where students would have some degree of face-to-face and attend school a couple of days a week and then continue with distance learning the remaining portion of the week.
Melissa, really quick, you said April 26th? Was that correct?
Oh, I'm sorry, August 26th.
August 26th, okay.
Thank you. It is also our intent, based on the feedback from our parents, we have roughly 8% of our parents at this moment in time that have indicated an interest in continuing with distance learning. And so it is the district's intent to create a kindergarten through 12th grade distance learning option for our families as well, for those that perhaps have autoimmune compromised health conditions that don't and they don't feel safe coming back to school.
You almost gave us a huge breaking story, Melissa. Del Segundo delays school for a year. We almost had that to talk about. But I'm okay. So I'm wondering, so as you know, it's a very tough budget year. How concerned are you about your ability to meet requirements given the state of the budget?
Well, I think the health and safety of students is paramount, and that's going to have to take priority over other items. And so is it a budget challenge? Absolutely. Schools across the state are facing a 10% budget cut. So health and safety is going to have to go to the forefront of what we spend our money on, and other items will have to go on the back burner for now.
Now, 10 superintendents signed a letter today with concerns about the framework, including the face coverings requirement, the ban on large gatherings. Do you share any of those concerns?
Well, I think that these aren't conditions that any of us certainly created. These are all after effects based on the needs, medical needs that are being identified by Department of Public Health. So I'm a believer, and we follow what medical guidelines and directives were provided. And so I believe that it's necessary.
Okay. Now, El Segundo Unified is, compared to LA Unified, a relatively small district, 8 campuses, 3,500 students. So wondering, Melissa, in your mind, is the size of your district maybe an advantage because there are fewer people to coordinate with? Or maybe is it a greater challenge given the resources and staff needed?
Well, I think it's all relative, but I do feel being a smaller district, we're a little more nimble and can adjust accordingly. I think also when we go to engage with our stakeholder groups to fine-tune what the reopening plan would be using the task force document as guidance, that we're able to work together more efficiently and seamlessly just based on size.
Talking to Melissa Moore, superintendent of El Segundo Unified School District. Wondering, Melissa, when we're talking about a future where students might be wearing masks or interact less with their classmates, I'd imagine that that could take an emotional toll during some prime developmental years. What kind of counseling or maybe social work services will be available to students?
Yes, in El Segundo Unified School District, we've adopted the RULER program from the Yale Institute for Emotional Intelligence. And this is actually one of our Board of Education goals, to promote social and emotional well-being of all our students and foster a positive learning environment. So what I anticipate is when students are on campus with the face-to-face interactions with teachers, that the RULER approach, which really talks about how students are feeling and they begin to identify emotions and can self-regulate those emotions and really get in tune with that, that will be a hallmark and of primary importance during the face-to-face time. I think it's important to note that mental health really needs to be the responsibility of every person. So in El Segundo, we've taken a systemic approach where we've trained all our faculty to be in tune with this program. In addition, we have counseling supports. We have additional resources for our families. And we have Care Solace, which is a service where families can go on and take a look at a specific issue or concern their child or they may be feeling and receive vetted resources that are reliable that they could access using health benefits or nonprofit services.
Melissa Moore is superintendent of El Segundo Unified School District. Melissa, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Have a great day.
It's been over 2 months since the city of Los Angeles pulled back and decided to stay at home in response to the pandemic. Now, slowly but surely, the window on our economy and by extension our lives is opening, for better or worse. Coming up, Mayor Eric Garcetti on the factors that go into that kind of a decision. That's coming up when Take 2 continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm Martinez. The city of Los Angeles is in day 70 of its stay-at-home order. Now, in that time, more than 1,000 people have died from COVID-19 in LA alone, and millions have lost their jobs or been furloughed. But restrictions have steadily relaxed in recent weeks, and just last night, Mayor Eric Garcetti said that all retail businesses can reopen today and allow in-store customers. For more, we have Mayor Eric Garcetti joining us via Zoom from City Hall. Welcome back.
Great to be with you, A. Thanks so much.
And good to have you. Now, first, the positive news. Last week, LA County's public health director, Barbara Ferrer, said in a statement that the county is now seeing, quote, steady declines in hospitalizations, deaths, and the percent of people testing positive. So, Mayor, what's your assessment of where the city of LA is so far? Are we really flattening that curve?
No question we have. There's six metrics that we track. And by all those measures, these are all very hopeful numbers, but not numbers that should allow us to relax. Even as we reopen, we have to really stay vigilant to make sure that we don't see spikes.
Last week, the Trump administration said it was concerned about the spread of the virus here. But at the same time, the Department of Justice sent a letter directly to you saying that the stay-at-home orders may be, quote, arbitrary and heavy-handed. So, Mayor, how do you square these two messages coming from the federal government?
I try to usually move beyond politics, which this kind of smelled of. You can't say you're too fast and too slow the same day. You should probably pick one line of attack if you're going to take on folks. And we're very proud of what we've done here in Los Angeles to lead, to save thousands of lives, to be one of the first cities to be a safer at home order, to lead with face masks. But the idea that, you know, Civil Rights Division or somebody else is sending a letter to LA, I think probably is more about politics than anything else.
So for the most part, do you ignore what's coming out of DC when it comes to you in LA, or do you try and take it with a grain of salt?
No, I reached out to the U.S. attorney, said, hey, if you have any questions, we had a nice conversation. Everybody's going to have health orders around the world, but we have to protect those who are vulnerable. We have to listen to science. And I'm just going to always follow data and the professionals in balancing our economic health and our physical health. So I think that health experts and industry hand in hand are the ones who I'll be listening to more than any politicians.
Now, yesterday you announced that in-store shopping as well as limited gatherings of people in places of worship can resume today. However, despite the encouraging stats lately, we are seeing new cases every day. Mayor, why does reopening these specific activities make sense in light of what we've seen with the science?
We don't want to strangle this economy to the point where Los Angeles never comes back or it takes a decade to come back. That would be devastating. At the same time, it's not a time to just go have fun. It's not a time to not use your discretion and just continue to stay home or work from home if you can. But we can increasingly allow these things in a safe manner. We'll keep a careful eye on all the numbers. If we ever have to hit a red light, we can do that. But in the meantime, let's hit this green or a yellow with some caution and take steps forward, because otherwise, 2 or 3 months more of this, our economy and our city will not survive economically.
On the economy, there have been a number of protests right on the steps of LA City Hall all over the country demanding that the economy reopen. Do you feel any pressure from those kinds of things to reopen?
Not from those protests. I respect people protest, but the ones who just say, open it all up, you know, that's to me not very nuanced. We have to look at...
Well, how about urgency, a sense of urgency to reopen up maybe?
Not always from those protests, but I think from a lot of people, and I come back to City Hall every single day where I've worked virtually every day of this crisis, and I tell my team, let's figure out how to do this safely. We're getting smarter every day. We're hardcore closers, and that was the right thing to do at the beginning. How can we be the strongest, safest openers at the same time now in this next phase?
And meanwhile, Governor Gavin Newsom announced that most of the state can move into stage three of reopenings, which includes businesses such as barbershops and salons. LA County not on the list to be reopened just yet. Are you on the same page with the governor on that?
I talked to the governor yesterday, and we're not necessarily always aligned in terms of what the state says can happen. and making sure that LA must do that. And it's okay for us to take sometimes a couple more days or sometimes a couple more weeks. We have to follow the numbers, but we give a lot of input. And what I think is a good role for government to do is to educate and to encourage.
Talking to LA Mayor Eric Garcetti. Now, earlier in the show, we talked about how the new reopening guidelines for schools released today by LA County's Office of Education. The LA Unified School District has not yet commented on those suggestions. Mayor, what conversations have you had with Superintendent Austin Buettner about when and how schools might resume in-person classes?
Well, we have to remember LAUSD is the second biggest school district in the country. So it will take time for them to work through the multiple campuses they have, if, how, and when they want to reopen in the fall, or looking at some of the ways that we can help in the summertime, where we're hoping to have some childcare, which has always been permissible, slash camps, which parents need to have, especially in lower income areas, if they're going to get back to work and they're permitted to get back to work. I do think that we have to look at this with the school district as not just an educational issue, but one that's about our economy. Parents won't go back to work if their kids can't go to school in some manner. But one of the things that I've offered help with is the testing. We have invested heavily in testing. We opened up at Dodger Stadium yesterday. We now have the capacity of testing more than 22,000 people a day throughout the county and city. We're going to need that for our students who aren't as vulnerable, but could be the silent spreaders and carriers. There's a lot of research going on that, but I think we're going to need that to make sure they're not endangering teachers and other school staff, and vice versa, not taking it home, especially where they might live with grandparents or other people who are vulnerable. So we're here to help that the school district get that sort of testing and to make those decisions. But I certainly am hopeful that in the fall, we can have some semblance of school. It won't be as we know it or remember it, but something that will help us get the parents back to work and make sure our kids see each other and don't fall further behind.
Well, that semblance, though, with the limited interaction among students, possibly taking temperatures, as you mentioned, sounds really expensive, especially with state budget cuts looming. How might the city be able to step in and help schools cover these costs?
Well, we're the opposite. I'd look up to the state to try to help us and other places. But I'll tell you what I've done so far is not only did I push strongly and successfully to get the coronavirus relief funds that were in the CARES Act, the first one, but now we need also this HEROES Act, which the House already passed. We need Mitch McConnell, the Senate, to take it up and to help states and local government and school districts. Our airports, our buses and trains won't survive. Our first responders will face huge cuts. We've already said 10% furloughs to non-emergency and critical workers in the city. And that's just going to continue in the school districts, our city, and our county if we don't have that assistance from the federal government.
You know, you mentioned how reopening schools has a lot more to do than just the kids in the classroom. You know, parents possibly going back to work, figuring out what they're going to have to do to pick up their kids after school. There's so much involved with sending kids back to school. Is there any kind of timeline that parents can hold on to?
A lot of this is evolving because we're looking at the data. But I hope that parents can not only plan, forget the fall for a moment. I'm focused right now on the summer and using some of our federal funds to open up our rec centers if we get the permission from the county, and to help especially families who can't afford childcare to have some place where they can essentially send kids. Camps are prohibited right now, but what's the difference between a camp where people are socially distanced and a childcare facility where people are in the same sorts of spaces? There's a lot of holes in our federal response. And so in the city, I'm trying to do everything I can to fill that. But it definitely starts with our lower income communities having some predictability about, you know, where the kids are going to be this summer. And I hope the district can give us some guidance soon about the fall as well.
All right. One last thing. Just stepping back and looking at this reopening. Some people in L.A. are taking precautions and the new normal seriously. But on Saturday, Mayor, I just felt like I needed to get out. So I took a drive through Venice just to look at the ocean and the beach from the safety of my car. And most people that I saw were not wearing face masks. They were clustered together. Mayor, it's day 70 of all this, and some people seem to be cracking. Is there anything you can say to regain people's trust and confidence that sticking to the safety plan is the right call?
Sure. I've always said in my briefings, I'm a combination of your high school athletic coach and Debbie Downer. Look, so let me start with the Debbie Downer. If we don't get this right, all these new expansions will result in more spread. The more spread will result in more cases and potentially our hospitals being overwhelmed and death. it'll devastate our businesses, it'll devastate our freedoms, and it'll devastate the lives that we have. So first and foremost, take personal responsibility, not because I've said it or government or the county or the state has said it. Do it because you care about your local businesses. Do it because you care about people with pre-existing conditions. Do it, and with masks, I especially say to the men, because it's often men, is real men wear masks. I know it's a cultural difference. The evidence is clear. Do it and help protect people.
It just makes someone like me, Mayor, feel like a sucker for following the rules.
No, don't feel like a sucker. To everybody out there who's listening who follows the rules, continue following the rules. Don't be, you know, don't yell at somebody. For instance, I've told my police officers I want to get them a whole bunch of masks. Instead of them coming up and saying, you know, you're supposed to wear a mask, is like, hey, you need a mask, and give it to people. I love those programs where I've seen in cities where we turn city employees into encouragers, educators, helpers. Let's just all collectively say we care enough about each other that these actions are acts of love, not of some sort of oppression.
That's Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti. Mayor, thanks a lot.
As always, A.
All right, now to some good news. As the summer approaches, many of us have canceled or postponed vacation plans. But as KPCC Stephanie O'Neill reports, a growing number of RV owners are finding a way to put their idle vehicles to good use in this pandemic.
Deborah Lesson Elliott of Woodland Hills is a nurse practitioner who works with diabetes patients. And while she feels fortunate she can avoid exposure to the virus by engaging in telemedicine, she's concerned for her colleagues on the front lines.
I really wanted to do something. So as I was searching around, I think, internet and Facebook and asking for opportunities to help contribute to the cause, I came across RVs for MDs.
RVs for MDs. It's a new Facebook group that pairs owners of recreational vehicles with healthcare workers who care for COVID-19 patients. Because of that, many are opting to live away from family in order to keep them safe from infection. And Deborah and her husband had an RV sitting idle in their driveway.
It's a 23-foot C-Class RV.
That's Chris Elliott. He says he and Deborah use the vehicle almost exclusively for summer camping at bluegrass and R&B music festivals, all of which have been canceled for 2020. So when Deborah told him about RVs for MDs, they both considered it a perfect fit.
We weren't going to be using it. It's like a musical instrument sitting around not getting played. It just seemed the only logical thing to do.
The RVs for MDs group launched on March 22nd. That's when a Texas woman went on Facebook to ask for housing help for her husband, an emergency room doctor. Another woman she'd never met answered her plea, and the two became friends and founders of the new group. So far, they've matched more than 1,400 frontline healthcare workers with borrowed RVs. Amber Bouton is a volunteer in charge of the pairings.
These are people doing this 100% for free out of the goodness of their heart. Not a cent is being exchanged. They're doing it to save lives.
And among the very first matches was that between the Elliots and Megan and Chris Negretti of Whittier. Chris is also a nurse practitioner who was returning to work in early April after a scheduled leave. The couple has a 6-year-old daughter and a 2-year-old son. Megan has asthma, a potential risk factor for COVID-19, so they were desperate to find Chris a place to live safely away from the family.
We had about a week to figure it out before he was going back to work. And it started to make him really nervous about being around us.
But thanks to the Elliots' decision to loan out their RV, he didn't have to go far at all.
Within 24 hours, we had it in our driveway. They brought it down for us and set it all up and taught us how to use it, and it's been great since.
Chris says living at home, albeit on the driveway, provides an almost normal family existence.
Usually I get home around when the kids are napping. And then I take a shower and the kids wake up, they play outside, and I come outside with them, but I social distance from them.
And that's challenging for everyone, emotionally and oftentimes logistically, especially, Chris says, when you're dealing with a toddler.
Sometimes he forgets about social distancing, and sometimes I have to run away from him because he runs towards me, but, you know, it's difficult for them to process sometimes, and yeah, it's been tough for them.
Just how tough became evident to the couple on May 15th. That's when Air Force Thunderbirds flew over Southern California to honor COVID-19 workers. Chris couldn't be there. He was working. Megan says as the flyby happened, their young daughter was brought to tears over missing a family life that, for now, is on hold.
So they've lost an innocence that a lot of kids still get to have. But I'm like, I also love that my kids' hearts are softening for other people.
And there are other valuable experiences the pandemic has brought to her children, not the least of which is witnessing the Elliott's generosity. Again, Deborah Elliott.
I said, when you return the RV, stop at Malibu State Park and take a couple of nights and camp out and really enjoy it before you bring it back.
When they'll bring it back is uncertain. But for now, Chris Negrete says he's grateful to have safe living quarters within feet of his front yard where he can watch his children play, even if it is just from a distance.
Nice job. What'd you make?
A turtle.
A turtle.
I'm Stephanie O'Neill.
Where's your monster truck? You want me to help you make it?
Stephanie O'Neill's reporting is supported through a journalism fellowship at the Natural Hazards Center, funded by Direct Relief. All right, we've seen black men take a lot of heat just for being black. While the margin for error seems narrow, what about for a hip-hop icon accused of sexual assault? Well, a new documentary tells the story of a woman who kept quiet because she did not want to let a culture down.
Film really is meant to lift up black women who love black men, not to tear anyone down.
Her story is coming up next when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, I'm Amy Martinez. Just want to take a moment to warn listeners that this next conversation will include a discussion about sexual assault. Filmmakers Amy Ziering and Kirby Dick have made three documentaries looking at the issue. Their 2012 movie, The Invisible War, was about sexual abuse in the military, and their 2015 movie, The Hunting Ground, was about rape on college campuses. Their new film, On the Record, zeroes in on the music industry, namely sexual assault accusations against hip-hop mogul Russell Simmons. Three women came forward in the film, but the one who is followed most closely is former Def Jam's record producer, Drew Dixon. Here's a clip from the trailer.
I didn't tell that many people about what happened with Russell. He just grabbed me. And I'm saying no. I was reduced to nothing in that moment. Nothing about anything that makes me who I am mattered.
The film tracks what happens when Dixon goes on the record with the New York Times in 2018. Originally, Oprah Winfrey was an executive producer, but she suddenly dropped out of the project earlier this year. She had been getting pressure from Russell Simmons, who denies the allegations and has not been charged with any crime, and from the rapper 50 Cent, but she denies her decision was a result of that. Today, the film is getting released on the new streaming service HBO Max. We spoke with Drew Dixon and Amy Ziering yesterday, and they began by talking about how the filmmakers first met Dixon. Here's Ziering.
We were just looking into women post-Me Too, and we were interviewing a large array of women from different industries, and Drew was one person we interviewed among many, and her interview was so exceptional and stood out that right after it, I called Kirby and I said, oh my God, I think this actually could be a film in itself.
So Drew, to you, what were your first reactions to the idea of participating in this documentary?
You know, I met Amy and Kirby before I even decided to go on the record, as is documented in the film. And I guess in some ways I felt, you know, I understood that you could never sort of unscramble the egg. Like if I didn't agree in the moment, there was no way to sort of recapture the moment. And I did think it was important to share kind of just how difficult the process is and how rigorous the process is. And this idea that you just like call a newspaper and your story ends up, you know, being printed is so far from the truth. So I wanted to reflect that. And I really had tremendous respect for Amy and Kirby as filmmakers. And, you know, I thought it was just the right thing to do. So I agreed. And that's when it was a Me Too documentary. And then months later, when they asked me if I would be willing to be more of a focus of a film centering the Russell Simmons survivors, first I said yes, then I said no, and then I said yes, because I thought it was this potentially once in a lifetime, maybe once in a generation opportunity to foreground the experience of Black women and the unique obstacles and vulnerability we face in terms of sexual violence and loss of bodily autonomy, and to have it, have our stories told by such capable, careful filmmakers seemed more compelling to me sort of as a activist and as a person, and overrode sort of my own fears as an individual and as a private citizen. And so that's why I ultimately decided to do it.
Amy Ziering, and since this is radio, we should note that you and Kirby are not African-American. You both are white. And this story has a lot to do with race and Black culture. So how did you make sure that you were checking your own possible blind spots and possible biases when making this film, Amy?
Well, as I mentioned, the film came about very organically. We did not set out to make this film per se, but we were just looking into Me Too and talking to a wide array of women about their experiences in different industries. Once we assembled together a set of interviews that we thought were powerful, we started shopping it to distributors. And one of those people we went to was Harpo and Ms. Winfrey. And when Ms. Winfrey saw the clips, one of which was a clip of Drew, she said, "Oh my God, this is amazing. I really want to do this as my first series for Apple. You know, they're launching a new platform, and you know, this is incredible, and this, I want to be part of this." So we started then at that point collaborating with her and working in close concert with her to forge this series on women post Me Too. In the course of doing that, Kirby and I were so kind of astounded and thought the material we were gathering story was so rich that we went back to her and said, "You know, will you just look at this rough cut? It kind of deserves its own longer set of real estate to sort of unfold and unpack. And we'd only do that if you wanted to collaborate on something like a more richer and deep exploration." Mm-hmm. And so she looked at a rough cut and she came back to us and said, "You know what? You're right. Let's embark on this together." So yes, even though we are white filmmakers, it really was from the get-go a co-collaboration with Ms. Winfrey, her team at Harpo, as well as the full team at Apple. And that's how we, right from the outset, decided, okay, this will help us absolutely check our blind spots.
And Drew, one point in the discussion is of a particular dilemma that some Black women feel of having to choose between aligning with their race and speaking out about their abuse. So how much was that a key part of your particular story?
That was a defining part of my story. My desire to protect the Black community, and in particular, Black men and boys who are vilified in America, is really one of the overwhelming reasons that I did not come forward for 22 years. I did not want to do anything to amplify the myth of dangerous and violent Black men, which cost so many of my brothers their lives and their liberty. I also didn't want to be banished from the community that I love. I love the Black community. One of the reasons I chose to pursue a career making hip hop records was because I wanted to amplify Black voices. And I also didn't want to undermine the progress of hip hop as an art form by undermining the momentum and the stature of Russell Simmons, who was so closely identified with the success of this emerging genre, which at the time that I worked at Def Jam didn't even have a category of its own at the Grammys. I mean, hip hop was still very marginalized and its future was still very uncertain. And so I didn't want to undermine the progress of a rare Black success story of that magnitude. I didn't want to undermine hip hop. I didn't want to make Black men and boys any more vulnerable. And I didn't want to be cast out by my community. So those were all reasons why I did not come forward.
We're talking with documentary filmmaker Amy Ziering, whose new movie is called On the Record, and also with record producer Drew Dixon, who is featured in the film. All right, so just days before the movie is set to debut at Sundance, Oprah Winfrey pulled out of the project as executive producer. Now, here's how she explained her decision on CBS News.
Russell Simmons has first of all, he's denied all of the allegations vigorously.
Yeah.
You again have said that you unequivocally support these women.
Yes.
Why are you making it a point to say that, even though you're withdrawing from the...
Because I believe that the women's voices deserve to be heard. And as an executive producer, I also was in a position where I thought some things were not right. I wanted the context of the story to be broadened. I wanted more women brought into the story.
Amy, what were your reactions to Oprah Winfrey's concerns about adding more women to the story or broadening it?
Well, all we can say is Oprah was a close collaborator. Ms. Winfrey was a close collaborator, loved the film. It was at Harpo's behest that Apple did the application for the film to go to Sundance. After the film was accepted to Sundance, Harpo called us and said, "We're so proud, we're so thrilled, we're going to do a press release announcing that this is our film." And then what happened then was that after they issued their press release, Sundance did its announcement the following day, and it inadvertently posted a picture of Drew. It was supposed to just say that it was an expose on the music industry, you know, focusing on, you know, women post Me Too. That's all it was supposed to say, but they inadvertently attached a picture of Drew. People figured out what kind of maybe the content was, and there started to be a very public campaign by Russell and 50 Cent against Oprah and against the film. And that's when everything changed. So we know from her extensive notes and from her collaboration throughout and from Apple's support that she was 100% behind the film. You'll have to ask her, you know, we can't answer to whatever issues she then said she had, but she loved it until she had a change of heart. And we are totally appreciative of her contributions, and the film never would have gotten to where it was or been empowered to even be made without her support.
Drew, considering Oprah's initial support and excitement over this project, what did you make of her decision when you heard that she made it?
When I first heard that Oprah Winfrey had seen a rough cut of the film about a year ago, actually now, I cried real tears of joy because I have admired Oprah Winfrey for as long as I can remember. My greatest fear in participating in the film in the first place was the blowback from the Black community. And the idea that I would be standing next to Oprah Winfrey to weather that storm was as comforting as anything I could have hoped for. So when in December, Ms. Winfrey herself became the target of the very backlash I feared, I was devastated. I was devastated for her. And then for it to culminate with her exit from the project was crushing. It really felt like the floor fell out from underneath me. I literally was like in the fetal position in my apartment for 72 hours. It was terrifying to go to Sundance, not knowing if the people at Sundance would be the only people who would ever see this film, and if we would be misunderstood as survivors by our community, because no one would ever get to see that this film really is meant to lift up Black women who love Black men, not to tear anyone down. And so it was terrifying, but I also believe things happen for a reason. And going to Sundance and standing with Sherry Cher and Salai and holding space for ourselves and our stories with Amy and Kirby and receiving such positive feedback to the film was transformational for all of us.
But at the end of things, Drew, did Oprah Winfrey fail you?
You know, that's such a hard question to answer. Oprah Winfrey disappointed me. Oprah Winfrey doesn't owe me anything. You know, I stand in my truth. I am a child of God, and I have two children, and I really live my life conscious of the way my choices impact them and, you know, impact my community in every sense. And so, you know, Oprah Winfrey disappointed me, but I don't know that she was in a position to fail me because I'm not really her responsibility. And she's responsible to her company and to her own her own, I guess, you know, her own conscience. And so I certainly would never, you know, question the obligations that she has to consider when she makes her choices.
Drew Dixon, Amy Ziering, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having us.
Drew Dixon is the former Def Jam's record producer at the center of the new documentary On the Record. The film was made by Amy Ziering and Kirby Dick. It's on HBO Max today. All right, Hollywood is still on hold, but lights, cameras might soon be in action very soon. We're going to find out what the industry is waiting for the curtain to go up on production. That's coming up when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us.
She packed my bags last night, pre-flight. 0 hour, 9 a.m. And I'm gonna be high as a kite by then.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. Guidelines for resuming TV and film production are on their way, but plus Disney World has an opening date. No word on Disneyland, though, quite yet, so let's go on the lot.
Hey, shut up! God, I wish you'd
stick your head out and yell.
You want a chocolate?
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
Rebecca Keegan is with The Hollywood Reporter. She's with us every Wednesday to guide us through all that Hollywood stuff. Hello, Rebecca.
Hi, A.
Hi. Now, retail shopping is back with modifications. Places of worship are reopened with restrictions. Even schools have received some suggested guidelines today. Lots of restrictions there, of course. So, Rebecca, where does the state stand when it comes to Hollywood resuming film and TV production?
Well, Governor Newsom had said last week that he was planning to release guidelines for film and TV production Monday, meaning Memorial Day. That did not happen. He's now saying he expects to announce them at the end of the week, perhaps over the weekend. He's conferring with studios and guilds about just what those plans and protocols ought to be.
Wondering what the holdup is. I mean, now I'm intrigued, Rebecca, as to why this is kind of, it's not taking long, but it's taking longer than we thought.
Yeah, a lot of people in the industry, frankly, were a little surprised that Newsom apparently felt confident enough to press forward as soon as he did. Many industry players feel like while people are very eager to get back to work, a reasonable startup is still at least 6 weeks away at the very earliest. You know, there are a lot of stakeholders here who need to agree that the plan is safe. There's producers, agents, guilds, studio execs. Mayor Garcetti has his own entertainment industry COVID-19 task force. There's another sort of industry task force. So it's just a lot of people who have to agree on how and when to reopen Hollywood.
So, okay, so that was the governor, and you mentioned all the different. What about LA County? Where does it stand when it comes to resuming production?
Well, here's the problem. LA, as we know, is behind much of the rest of the state in terms of having this pandemic under control. But opening up film and TV production in California without opening it in LA, where all the studio lots are, would be kind of like opening New York State to the finance industry, but not opening Wall Street. Yeah. I mean, it's sort of like, what's the point? So LA is probably slowing this down a little bit because the pandemic is obviously more serious here.
Is there any hint or insight into what guidelines might be implemented, what it might look like, a set might look like post-pandemic?
Oh, yeah, there's been a lot of discussion about this. I mean, one interesting thing is that there will possibly be a safety coordinator whose whole job is making sure COVID-19 safety practices are being implemented, kind of like there's a Humane Society consultant for animals. There would be a COVID consultant on each set. Of course, there's going to be stepped up cleaning of gear and props, food individually packaged as opposed to buffet style catering, and lots of masks, gloves, temperature checks, social distancing, et cetera.
Yeah, a lot of work to hammer down the guidelines probably for till they come out. Now, one filmmaker, though, is taking things into his own hands, and that's Tyler Perry. He plans to resume production at his Georgia studio lot in July. What kind of safety plans does he have in place?
Yeah, the studio had sent out a 30-page memo to the casts of two shows he plans to start shooting on his lot in July, titled, quote, Camp Quarantine, and it's very involved. 16 days before people are due on set, they'll have to take a nasal swab COVID test and then self-quarantine until they report to set. They'll be flown to Atlanta via Perry's private jet. They'll remain in their cars and receive a second instantaneous COVID test while their luggage is sanitized. And then once they arrive on his lot, they'll be retested again. So it's the third COVID test before they even start shooting. And then once they're inside the quarantine bubble, they won't be allowed to leave that bubble for the entire duration of the shoot.
That sounds extensive and expensive. I'm wondering if this is a blueprint maybe for the new normal in Hollywood.
Yeah, it is expensive. I mean, there's no question these safety protocols are going to add a significant cost to the budgets of films and TV shows. I think it's also interesting that Perry, who is the first Black studio owner and who employs predominantly Black casts and crews, acknowledged in this note that he wrote the disproportionate impact COVID-19 has had on the Black population in the U.S. So it's sort of noteworthy on a number of fronts that his may be the first American studio truly getting back to work.
Talking to Rebecca Keegan with The Hollywood Reporter. All right, let's move on from the sets to theaters. IPIC Theaters has released its plan for reopening in June, and it's important to specify that this goes for Texas theaters. Still no word on L.A. locations. Rebecca, what are some of the plans the chain has in place for customers?
Temperature checks, staggered seating, no more pillow service. You know, IPIC are those fancy theaters where you're essentially in a Barca lounger. So it's going to be important to keep those loungers clean. Staff will be masked and gloved, and patrons will be encouraged to wear masks. As you said, this is Texas, not here in LA, where rules about masks in public are different there than they are here.
You know, when those seats are too comfortable, Rebecca, I fall asleep. I can't do
it. I know.
I need to just be uncomfortable to stay awake in a movie theater. Okay. So what kinds of safety precautions will the staff be required? The staff itself, when it comes to reopening?
Well, they'll have masks and gloves. There will not be concessions of the type that people are used to. So both the people coming to the theater to watch a movie and the people working in it will be, you know, wearing PPE effectively.
And the summer, I mean, it's blockbuster season. So is that the reason for the timing, that it's not that coincidental, considering that it is prime movie time?
Yeah, I mean, so many of this summer's planned tentpole movies were moved, and theater owners and studios are now doing this sort of tentative dance together as they think about reopening. First big studio movies, Chris Nolan's Tenet from Warner Brothers and Nicky Caro's Mulan from Disney, are still on the calendar for July. Theaters need to be open in major markets like New York and LA for that to be a sort of financially sensible move for those two studios. Right now, I would describe that as a finger crosser.
One more thing, Rebecca, really quick. Theme parks, the Disneys, where are they in terms of reopening?
Well, Walt Disney World is set to start reopening July 11th. The Magic Kingdom and the Animal Kingdom will open then. Then on July 15th, Epcot and Hollywood Studios will open.
All right. Rebecca Keegan's with The Hollywood Reporter. She joins us every Wednesday to talk all things showbiz. Rebecca, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
All right, so in closing, we have a question for you. As LA County and beyond ease of stay-at-home orders, how are you stepping out and doing it safely? What has reopening been like for you personally, and what are you seeing from others? Tweet us your thoughts. You can find us at Take Two. That's at Take Two. All right, while you can find the show there at Take Two on Twitter, you can also find me there as well. I'm at amartinezLA. That's at amartinezLA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back, as always, tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.